And now Iowa Contemporary Art presents Icon Art Radio.
It's Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple. Well, we're in the studio with Michael and Charlotte Kane. We're so lucky to have them here, and we're so lucky to have them back in Fairfield for a little while before they take off again. We were just talking, and Donna was thinking of an angle on this discussion in this show. Go ahead and ask that question.
Well, it's just my curiosity always works this way. I like to go back to the first tender impulses of anything, no matter what. And so last week when you were talking about your current art process in India for the last some decades, I went way back and just wanted to know how each one of you first felt the either tender or bold impulse to create something. When you were young, what made you want to be an artist?
Well, in my case, my parents were both professional artists and art professors, and I grew up surrounded by art materials. I actually lived in a room that smelled of turpentine from the adjoining studio that my father had when I was a little boy. So I guess I developed the addiction of being near art materials and sort of playing with them from early childhood. I don't really know what I did first. I do recall that in nursery school, I apparently modeled an elephant of some kind out of something like plasticine or some kind of three-dimensional material that was noted by many people. It was later thrown back into the bin that it came from, so I have no idea what it looked like. But that story stayed with me as I grew up, and I thought it was surprising, in fact, later on, that I had been involved in modeling, because about the time when I turned 50, for what in my conscious recollection was the first time, I started making things in wax, which is a modeling process, and I discovered that I had a great affinity for it, and it was very satisfying to me, sort of connecting back to a childhood incident, or perhaps even a childhood practice, of which I have no recollection. Mm-hmm. But I was mainly when I started to think of myself as being focused in artistic work, I was mostly writing poems. This was kind of an adolescent energy. It happened to me when I was in high school and then continued in college for a number of years. My poetry writing was very spontaneous. It involved a kind of inspiration, often taking place many hours into the night when I got into it. And there was kind of a collapse of the process for me when I found that I wanted to work in a medium that was more non-personal, more abstract, more universal. I kept finding that the first-person pronoun in various experiences that my poems frequently narrated were not as interesting as the idea of fields of information or energy that I might be able to somehow configure physically. I was an English major in college, and I was very lucky that I continued just sort of on the side, and 1 year slightly in a more focused way, I left college and went to New York City and studied at the Art Students League. And on the basis of this sort of sporadic activity, I was able to put together a portfolio that made me a competitive applicant for the Yale School of Art, which is still one of the top educational institutions in this country. And it's always been kind of hard to get in there, but somehow I had some good recommendations and managed to gain admission. The work that I was doing at the time when I went there quickly lost its charm for me because I was kind of doing realistic paintings that were based on some ideas, abstract ideas about composition. And I'd read a bunch of theoretical works on the golden mean and things of this sort that I thought constituted a sort of universal basis for success in the arts. But as I got to know some of the other students, there was a very brilliant group of carefully selected students who were at Yale, and also started to tune into, as everyone had to at this time, I enrolled in Yale, I believe in 1963, and this was the time when the Beatles music and the Rolling Stones music was just starting to appear on the scene. There was this extraordinary sense of new possibilities of kind of a mixture of high art and low art, of pop culture, and some very rich, deep, complex expressions that could appeal to a very broad segment of the public. And my fellow students and I engaged in a dialogue that ranged from fascination with psychedelics, meditation, and also with music. We were all visual artists, but we were really interested in any kind of plastic phenomena that could articulate rich patterns. And one of the great things that happened for us during this period is that a book called Tantra Art by Ait Mukherjee, an Indian scholar and museum director. In fact, he was the predecessor, the director of the National Handicraft Museum, which was later directed by Jyotindra Jain, the man who sent Charlotte and I to, among others, Vijay Sharma and various craftsmen that I worked with. Ait Mukherjee, back in the 60s, published a series of works which I think were revelatory for many people. Tantra art, Tantra asana, I can't remember the names of the others, but those were the first two at least. And these books gave us an idea about a new kind of abstract imagery which would link the cosmic to everyday life. And we also found out about that same time about an ethnomusicology program at we were living in New Haven, and I was a student at Yale. Many of my fellow students and I found out that it was Leyen University, about an hour's drive away. There was an ethnomusicology program where Indian music concerts were held every week. And we became regular attendees of this program, where we met a bunch of primarily South Indian musicians who were traditional classical performers. And these guys were doing just wonderful, wonderful things. Every weekend we would hear these concerts that would go on for maybe 5 or 6 hours, maybe not quite that long always, but on special occasions. And we would just sit listening to this abstract field of sensory information that seemed unbelievably rich. And on this basis, some of my fellow students and I decided that we would make some light sound art that would be public in its venue. We didn't want to work. We were against making objects. We were against selling things to collectors. We wanted to do something that would like the incredible popular music of the time, be enjoyed by a much broader public. And we also had a concern that we wanted to create some kind of an art form which would transform technology into as life-supporting, as deeply enriching an experience as humankind had primordially enjoyed in its relation with nature, because we felt that the human environment was increasingly being overwhelmed by man-made, and in particular by technological phenomena that were not necessarily designed for their sensory enrichment or the well-being of the users of the various devices and systems that were characterizing ever more and more the landscape. And so we started working with a bunch of different kinds of equipment, light and sound sources, and various ways of programming light and sound sources. This was very early on in humankind's ability to record and manipulate information. We worked initially with analog reel-to-reel tape recorders on which we recorded various signals, which we then used to turn on lights and to make sounds that were played back through loudspeakers. And we created some overall fields of light, sound, energy, initially in an interior space that we rented that we thought were quite remarkable and which people who came to see the work were very impressed with. And we later were able to do similar pieces in public spaces. For example, there was a large kind of gallery in one of the buildings that Yale had its graduate program in, where we presented to the public every night for maybe 4 or 5 months a light sound piece that was an abstract event. Each evening's program was unique, and this event was sort of made known to people by word of mouth. The place was full every night that we opened the door, and it was full of an amazing mix of people. This was in 1968, I think, in New Haven. This was the time when Huey Newton and the Black Panthers were organizing potential riots, race riots, in a suburb of, or I should say in an area of New Haven that it is directly adjoining the Yale University campus. We had, ourselves involved in meditation, very interested in meditation, and there were people in our community. This was specifically transcendental meditation. Maharishi had come through and given a lecture, and a lot of us had learned meditation, and there was this incredible political activity in New Haven of the Black Panthers, who it was thought were going to riot, and there'd been some grisly incidents and whatnot. And then there were all these there was this huge intellectual community of Yale itself, and there were all kinds of art critics and artists coming from New York City and even further afield to see our work every night in this very public space. And a lot of the Black Panthers and people like that were coming very regularly, and it was just a wonderful kind of meeting place. And it was pretty dark and kind of abstract in the space. It wasn't like a place where people had conversations. The signal level was high.
Loud.
Sometimes the
quite loud
noises were loud, and some
and
of the
and this was this is
bright.
The group that was called Pulsa.
Yes.
Yeah. And how long did that go on?
We worked together for 5 years.
Wow, because I've heard about this.
The work changed a lot. We moved from work in interior spaces to work in public outdoor parks and museum courtyards and things of that sort. We followed the piece, this incredibly successful piece at Yale, with a piece that we did in the Boston Public Garden that was really very neat. The Boston Public Garden, as anyone who lives there would know, is graced by an hourglass-shaped pond, which is frequented in the right season by swan boats. They're these little pedal-operated boats that people, I'm sure many of your listeners have actually ridden in this boat. And we were given some money by HUD and Boston Redevelopment to create a light sound event in the pond. It happened in the month of October, just after the swan boats had been pulled out. And our principal light source prior to this piece in Boston was banks of fluorescent tubes that we fired electrostatically. But in the case of the Boston demonstration, as it was called, we used strobe lights, which were quite large, and which we placed about 6 inches underwater in a pattern. There were about 60 of them in a kind of a linear array in this pond. And we were able, using punch paper tapes, which we had to go to MIT, the computers were not things that individuals owned in these days, but we could go to MIT and use their computers. And we went there and made punch paper tapes, and we had this punch paper tape reader, and we were able to program patterns like huge sweeps and, wow. and linear movements. And all around the edge of the pond, there were 36 polyplanar speakers. I'm sorry. Yeah, I think 36 is the right number. Maybe there were 36 strobe lights. I'm thinking maybe there were, no, there were 55 strobe lights, and there were 55 polyplanar speakers. And the speakers were these flat speakers that were weatherproof, that were mounted all around the edge of the pond. And we were able to sweep sounds and lights around in patterns. The event was more or less unannounced. There were some placards that appeared in the subway and in a few places, but it just started happening one night. And the Boston Public Garden is along a pathway which is frequented by people on their way home from work. Thousands and thousands of people walk across a bridge that goes right across the neck of the Swan Pond. And one night, suddenly, there were these extraordinary phenomena going on in the water. And many, many people were very, very pleased.
Is there any documentation of these events?
Well, there were articles in art magazines.
Photo documentary.
We took some photos. I don't know of film or video. We had a funny attitude. We thought that we were very...
Well, I had that funny attitude myself in those days. We're still funny today, but I know
what
you're saying.
To me, this story that you just told was an art piece in itself. I mean, from the little plasticine elephant to the smell of turpentine all the way to, you know, I just kept like, it was so visual. Your expressions were so visual. I felt like I was right there in every moment.
Well, I'm loving that we're documenting these guys' history a little bit.
I know.
And we need to get to Charlotte's history a little bit. We might have to do another show, but let's have a try to do 9 minutes of it here.
I want to say, though, that Michael is going up back to that, and he'll tell you a little bit about this.
Well, these guys have been talking a little bit. And
I
this
mean, even
is
the piece that's at Icon right now has a little flashing light.
Oh, I know. I like the flashing light.
And Michael has been offered time at an institute in Delhi in October called Khoj, where he's going to be working with some light electrical people, you know, to start to put things
Well,
into
this
his
is
sculptures.
Exciting. I'm looking forward to where
Maybe
this is going
walking,
to go.
We don't know.
Being from California, I'm identified with the light and space art movement, and it's definitely something I'm very much into.
So
let's have a brief synopsis of your history.
My history is I was not from the kind of art family that Michael was from. I mean, his father was friends with Jackson Pollock. I mean, you know, they were real artists from New York City. They lived in the Village. They had a loft. And when Michael was born, they moved out of New York. So Michael definitely has the whole of the American art history in his background. I am from an engineering father and who loved mathematics. He loved it so much. It was a work of art for him. And a mother who was a designer. And she was a dress designer, and she taught at the Rhode Island School of Design, and she worked in 7th Avenue in New York. And I was exposed to design all my life, and illustration, illustrating beautiful clothes. And I didn't...
So did you start doing drawings of
I used to
models
do, I used to do models. I used to do all of that. I used to sew. I did that for years, and then I went to the Rhode Island School of Design, and I still sort of stayed in the design part of it. I never got into the fine arts like Michael. It didn't occur to me that I could do such a thing. My father wanted me to teach. If you're going to graduate from an art school, you've got to do something to make money. So I became a primary school and a high school teacher, and I met Michael. and I discovered fine art. And I discovered his parents, who took me on as another little Michael and inspired me to do some work. And then I realized, well, I love fabric. I've been brought up with fabric. I've been brought up with a designer. I started knitting. And then I started knitting these huge hangings. There's one in Ames, Iowa, in the Symphony Hall. And that got me going. And I got a National Endowment grant for that, which sent me to India in 1980 for the, what was that course called that Maharishi had with 7,000 people in Delhi? Well, I couldn't stand any of the lectures, and neither could Michael. So we sneaked out every single day. And I would go to these places and buy ethnic fabrics that I started painting on. Mm. Of course, I was sent there with money from an art grant, so I had to do a little art while I was there. So, I mean, I got both parts. It was nice. Whenever Maharishi spoke, I was there, but whenever anyone else was speaking, we were out there. And I still have some of those fabrics. They were fabulous. And I did very well with those fabrics. I painted patterns upon patterned fabrics. I stretched them. I showed them at a wonderful gallery in Chicago, who then introduced me to a gallery in New York City, where I started having one-person shows. And I just started becoming a real professional artist. And I was always, though, searching for the proper technique for me. I never felt that good. I liked knitting, but knitting, you know, and I liked painting on patterned fabrics, but I was working with acrylics, and they weren't very fine. And because I'd been meditating, I wanted to do something really fine. I wanted to do something that brought me within myself and brought me happiness and bliss. And not until I met Banu Sharma and Vijay Sharma of India did I find a technique where I could just zero in on silence, really. And at that point also, actually early on in the 70s, I met a very great artist named Agnes Martin. She came to MUM. She gave a talk for our students. She was working, she calls it abstract expressionism. It wasn't. She was working with geometric patterns.
But she felt more identified with the abstract expressionist, didn't she, than the minimalist, because there was more...
Yes. We would call her a minimalist, but she wasn't... She felt very much identified with the abstract expressionist because she felt that her work was completely intuitive. Even though it was geometric, very geometric, it was extremely intuitive. My work was extremely geometric also, and I wanted to become more intuitive. And I didn't know how to do that until I started using these squirrel hair brushes and making lines. And now I'm starting to put the two together, which makes me very happy.
Did you know Agnes Martin personally? Did you become friends?
Yes, we became friends. She's come to MUM two, maybe three times.
Three times.
And she said she'll never go to a place more than once, and she came here. She stayed with me. We had wonderful talks. At one point when I was doing botanical drawing, she said, "Charlotte, you know, you really are an artist, but you're not a flower painter." Which I thought was very sweet. And when I used to go to visit her every couple of years, we'd drive across the country and stop in New Mexico and show her my work. And she loved my knitted hangings. She thought I should be in New York City at that point. She loved my pattern paintings. She did not love my flower paintings. They're illustrations, you know. But she really loved the paintings I did from India, to such a point that 3 years ago, 4 years ago, a year before she died, she looked at them and said, "Would you make a swap with me?" And I said, "Agnes, I'd love to make a swap with you, but your pictures are worth $500,000. And she said, "Well, I don't know if my gallery will let me." And I thought, come on now. She's your painting guru. You give her one. So I did. She hung it up on the spot, and she wrote to me. What did she say, Michael? I've repressed it somehow.
Well, one of the things she said was that she knew of no other artist whose work had such purity. And she also said that Charlotte's painting hanging on her wall gave her great comfort.
Comfort.
Wow.
And then she died 2 years ago. I'm sad that her little body isn't here, her bigger body isn't here anymore. But she's someone who painted from the age, she painted when she was younger, but she didn't really become known or show until she was in her late 40s.
Well, she didn't really find herself.
She didn't.
I mean, she was looking and looking and looking, and finally when she found the grid, I think she worked, and she had found a place to take off from.
Right.
And she's just...
Yeah.
Such a great
but I
example.
And her work really has to do with consciousness and nothing
Absolutely.
Else.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's completely intuitive. It's very delicate and it's very refined. And it has to do with universal qualities. But she also worked along with a man who I respect very highly named Rothko. And he died early on. He died early on. But his paintings were mostly fields of color. But as you look at them, you sort of see how consciousness is coming out. They're prayers. They're real prayers.
Yeah,
beautiful.
He's my hero, too.
Michael and I went to Washington, D.C., to the Museum National Gallery, and there's a room of five or six of his big pieces. And the first time I walked into that room, I started crying.
Well, that's what he does. He was able
Michael
to...
Michael has a video of me crying in front of these paintings.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
Tears rolling down my
head. I do, too.
He's empowered these objects with spirit,
with
subtle powers.
At the Boca in L.A.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember that show.
I walked in there.
It was Ponza's collection.
I just...
And others.
Burst into tears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they're such a classic example of art that cannot be reproduced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone has seen pictures of Rothko paintings.
Yeah, I don't know
you
what
think,
they are.
Oh, it's a little blotch of color, big deal. Mm-hmm. But the paintings are something else entirely.
This is where form becomes consciousness. And these are two artists that have done it, Agnes Martin and Rothko.
Indeed.
And my dear Banu Sharma, who says that it is Saraswati.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.